This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This month, Michael Tilson Thomas became the music director of the San Francisco Symphony. He's also principal guest conductor of the London Symphony Orchestra and artistic director of the New World Symphony, a Florida-based orchestra of young musicians. At the age of 50, Tilson Thomas's career as a wunderkind is behind him. He was only 24 when he first conducted the Boston Symphony Orchestra, filling in mid-concert for the ailing conductor. He was later appointed principal guest conductor of the Boston Symphony Orchestra. He was music director of the Buffalo Philharmonic from 1971 to 79. He discusses his life in music in the new book, Michael Tilson Thomas, Viva Voce. I asked him about the best and worst parts of taking over an orchestra.
The best part of it is the excitement of working with a whole new ensemble of talented people and getting to understand their personalities and really getting to understand how one can work with them and collaborate with them. The excitement of discovering people who have their own original take on things and realizing that in combination with what you have to offer, some kind of new synthesis will indeed result, and that'll get over the footlights and be thrilling for us and thrilling for those who listen to us. And I think the hardest part about it is that really taking over a major American orchestra as music director is somewhat like becoming the new head of General Motors. Or it's an enormously daunting process there. It's a huge organization, and it's difficult to get a grasp of just what all of its activities may be and how one can, you know, best influence and direct these things.
When you were learning stick technique in and you were younger, did you think that being a conductor would also mean, you know, fundraising and administrative work and salary decisions and all that stuff?
No, I didn't really think about that. I mean, I certainly knew from the very beginning that music, even classical music, is a very spiritual and very elevated form of show business, and that show business involves always capturing one's audience imagination, and that to a certain extent, the more one assumes responsibility for the details of production and support of the show, one has greater and greater control of what the final artistic product will be.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned show business, because I want to talk with you a little bit about your background.
Sure.
Your grandparents were stars of the Yiddish theater, Boris and Bessie Tomaszewski. And I think your grandfather died just a few years before you were born.
Correct.
In, 38 or 39?
Right.
And you say, what, 30,000 people attended his funeral?
That's correct.
That's extraordinary.
I found that out. I never realized that until just recently. I found the old New York Times piece on his funeral, and there were the pictures of Second Avenue closed off totally and this huge parade of people going out to the cemetery in Brooklyn where he was buried.
What did it make you think about when you found that out?
Well, he was such a larger-than-life character. I mean, in Jewish households, it was always kind of a thing people would say when a child was particularly outrageous or loud or carrying on in some way. They'd say, don't do me a Tomaszewski, because he had a reputation for being, you know, a larger-than-life actor on stage who did melodramatic parts and romances and things like this. And, of course, he had a tremendous reputation also as a Don Juan of Second Avenue. But he also was an enormously courageous man in bringing hundreds, perhaps thousands of people over from the old country and in supporting all kinds of theater, Shakespearean theater, but also the first performances in the United States of Chekhov, Ibsen, Strindberg, Hauptmann, Andreev, very avant-garde things. Shows as well that were the prototypes of what the American musical ultimately became. He was a guy who could do, he could play Hamlet, but he could also do musical comedy, and he could, melodrama. He could do it all, and that was somewhat confusing to later biographers. There's still a definitive text to be done on him, or indeed on the whole meaning of what the Yiddish theater is in the history of American society.
Did you grow up thinking that you literally had show business in your blood?
Oh, I absolutely knew that, especially because I grew up around my grandmother, Bessie Tomaszewski, Boris's wife, who some people say was a greater star than even he. She was a tremendous actress, a natural talent. She had gone on the stage for the first time when she was about 13 and a half years old. And she became a huge headline, first as a tragic actress, and then in her mid-40s, she converted her career into being a major comedian. And she created a number of characters on the stage, one very famous one, Minka the Dienstmoint, Minka the Housemaid, which was a kind of Yiddish kite Pygmalion story. And in this play and others, she created that character that Fanny Brice and Molly Picon and even Barbara Streisand are still playing to this day, that kind of wry, wise, Americanized Jewish woman who has lots of personality and lots of mischief behind their enormous wisdom.
So did she teach you anything about singing or acting when you were growing up?
Well, lots of things. I mean, she told me the history of the theater in enormous detail, and she recited scenes from it. And when I was a very young kid, she took me onto the stage of the Pasadena Playhouse, and we were standing on the stage, and she said, I must have been three or four at this time, she said, look up, Michala, look up, and look up. What do you see far, far away? And I said, well, I see lights. And she said, look further up. And I said, far way up there, you see that light up there? It says exit. I said, oh, yeah, that's very far away. She said, well, up there, that's the second balcony or the gallery. And up there are the cheapest seats. And in those seats sit the people who love the show the most.
That's interesting, yeah.
She said, and whenever you're doing on stage, if you're whispering, if you're singing, if you're, you know, soliloquizing, whatever you're doing, you must remember that it must reach those people. The intent of what you're doing must reach those people. You must be generous to reach your whole audience. So things like that were very valuable advice, of course.
You know, in your new book, you say, I knew the names of the great Yiddish actors and plays of the turn of the century, but I knew none of the names of the baseball players or even the baseball teams in America.
That's absolutely true.
Were you mocked for that?
I was certainly considered different, but I was in my own sort of world. I mean, I guess the worst was there was a key game of kickball played in elementary school when I was out in extreme left field in a place where hopefully no ball ever would be kicked. And the night before, my grandmother had been doing some readings from the Oresteia, and I was really brooding on, you know, Clytemnestra's motivation, and after all, her daughter was killed, and this and that, and I was thinking all this, and suddenly a ball arrived and actually hit me. I had no idea it was coming. It hit me. I didn't catch it, and as a result, our team lost, and so I was roughed around a bit by the my fellow teammates for having been so inattentive. I think that was the worst moment.
Your parents moved to Los Angeles in the late 30s?
Correct.
Your father worked in the Hollywood industry, in the movie industry, as a scriptwriter, dialogue director. He changed his name from Tomaszewski to Thomas.
Right.
What was his reason for doing that? Was it an ethnic thing? I mean, everybody was changing their ethnic names to something more.
No, American, it wasn't sound. That. It was just that Boris and Bessie were so, so famous that every time my father would go to try and get some job, people would see the name Tomaszewski and they'd say, what? You're the son of Boris Tomaszewski? And he said he could never sort of get past that. He wanted to do what he wanted to do on his own merits. And he didn't want to be confused with what it is my grandparents had done.
Did he ever regret changing his name? And do you ever regret that he changed it?
He certainly didn't. From time to time, I have. There was one point in my early career when things were moving very fast, and suddenly someone came to see me and said, in 20 minutes, you're going to be on national television, and you have to decide now if you want to keep your name as Thomas or change back to Tomaszewski. And I had 20 minutes to decide it, and I couldn't reach my parents, and I thought, gosh, this is the name they gave me out of respect for them. I'm not changing it. And it's terribly difficult for some people to grasp who are not English, that is, a name like Michael Tilson Thomas. But over the years, it's more and more becoming MTT, and gosh knows, here in San Francisco, it's really become MTT.
Mm-hmm. Michael Tilson Thomas is my guest. He's the new conductor of the San Francisco Symphony. He remains the principal conductor of the London Symphony Orchestra and artistic director of the New World Symphony. He also has a new book called Michael Tilson Thomas, Viva Voce. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with conductor Michael Tilson Thomas. As a teenager, you participated in the premiere of works by Boulez, Stockhausen, Copland, Stravinsky. You worked with them directly, yes?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. So did they give you a sense of what to expect if you made music into your life? You know, if you lived the life of a musician?
Well, they did. Many people did. I mean, also Copland and of course, very much Piatigorsky.
Mm-hmm.
And Ingolf Dahl, my incredible teacher, really was my central teacher in many ways. But I very early perceived that there were some people in the music business who had been playing music for their whole lives, who seemed to be ennobled and transfigured nearly by the process of making music, and others who seemed to be very unhappy and embittered by the experience of making music. And so I was trying from the very beginning to understand what was the difference between these people. Where did the choice lie between having a life in music that made you very, very happy or one that made you very frustrated?
What were you able to figure out?
Well, I decided way back then that it was important for musicians to kind of take a musical Hippocratic oath before they went into the profession.
And what is the oath?
That you have to discover that it's just necessary for you to make music. I mean, to be a musician, you have to love music as much as eating or sleeping or dreaming or all those other ings. It has to be something that you just must do every day. And you can't be sure when you enter the profession of music where it may take you. It is uncertain. It depends a lot on being very well prepared and being in the right place at the right time. But I remember a moment when I was around 18 or 19, and I was walking on the USC campus where I was going to school, and I thought to myself, well, I know that I'm good enough. I know I'm good enough. I could be a university musician, and there are wonderful things happening at this music school of great quality and expression. And if I could do this, as long as I can make music, I'll be very happy. And if it turns out that I can make music in some larger arena, well, we'll see about that. But I know that it's music itself, which is this process, this dialogue with something in my spirit that I must pursue. And then I knew I was going into music with no other agenda. It was just the music itself that mattered. And it was those people for whom music truly mattered who were the ones that had wonderful lives as musicians.
Now, when you said you thought musicians should take a Hippocratic oath, I thought it would be, you know, first do no harm, and that would be something like never perform boring works.
Well, never perform with your heart not being in it. Never allow yourself to get to the point where it's a job. Always make sure that your spirit is focused so that communicating music to other people is a central priority for you.
I have a conducting question. I mean, a stick question. You studied, you know, classical stick technique. How much of that do you use now, and how much of your technique is based on what you've like learned and improvised over the years?
It's definitely a mixture of both. I think the easiest way for you to understand this is that there's a constant give and take process going on in the rehearsals and in the performance itself. So there are certain key moments where I have to really indicate the exact ictus of a certain moment in time to get around a particular corner. And then having done that, then what I want to do is sort of turn over the lead of the music to perhaps a solo oboe player or perhaps the viola section or maybe a brass chorale. All those different groups within the orchestra have their own reaction time. They all take breaths at a different speed. They all have a different way of interreacting, and it's possible with my baton or with a little bit of body language or in using my eyes a lot, mostly in using my facial expression, my contact with the orchestra shapes all those things.
You were very close to Leonard Bernstein. Do you feel like you learned a lot about conducting technique from him?
of course, I learned a lot from him by observing him, and mostly through the kind of colloquy concerning music that we had over many years. When I was studying pieces, I had the opportunity to, you know, to call him up and ask questions, and in the best kind of a rabbinic style, almost always when I asked him a question, he would ask me a question back. And by this kind of dialogue of questions, you know, he would help me to really find my own way of doing the music. And that was, of course, terrific. And I guess my conducting style has become a lot freer. It's a lot more economical now, maybe, than it was 10 years ago. But, you know, these things change. I can only say that now it feels to me in the repertoire that's really mine that as if I'm making the music happen in space, as if I'm touching the notes and actually molding them and shaping them in some kind of plastic way, you know, within time itself.
Let me ask you a question very, very bluntly. Do you worry about the classical music audience dying out? In America, a lot of the classical music audience is older, and a lot of people worry that they're not being replaced by a new, younger classical music.
That is a very serious concern. Larger repertoire and larger audience are the two most important issues in classical music today, and these are both issues we are very actively addressing here in San Francisco.
How?
We already have a somewhat younger audience than in other parts of the country, and the sort of programming that I'm doing, and I'm happy to say it seems that when I do conduct, that more younger people do show up at the box office because they're interested in the kind of programming I present, which is a combination of music that is diverting, challenging, and reaffirming, and which exploits the possibilities of contrast and in a concert program, and gives you maybe something more to think about than just the music. It causes you to think a little bit about, well, how did these different composers approach this experience of war, peace, reconciliation? It's also something I'm focusing on very much with my musicians at the New World Symphony, because I have this orchestra of young musicians I'm working with in Florida, and that orchestra not only is involved in developing their techniques as performers and making them consummate performers of Baroque music and contemporary music and the whole gamut of music, but also enabling them to speak and present themselves before an audience of both children and adults and kind of get them beyond the formality of classical music and into, you know, its central message.
So I must ask you, what do you think of people who, when they listen to classical music, start conducting? You know, when they're listening to a record, their arms start flapping about.
Good for them. if it moves them, they should enjoy it. That's what it's all about. Music is about being moved and about being touched, and that's what it should be.
You were on the road with James Brown once, right?
Well, I was with him for a couple of days. I met him in Boston. He was doing a show in a small jazz club, and I told him I was a great admirer of his, and he said, well, come on the road, you know, see how we do it. Because I asked him how he got the band to be so tight. And this was the time when he was doing Sex Machine, was his big hit. And I spent 3 or 4 days with him in Atlanta and Augusta and in Washington, D.C., watching from backstage just what he did. And it was a great thrill.
So did you learn anything you could apply?
Absolutely, because what I realized that he was focused on the exact duration of the perceivable present. In every particular piece, the stroke of the beat had a certain length. He wanted the trap drummer to be out in front and the hand drummer to be in the back and the bass player to be right in the center, and he had an exact idea of how wide in time that stroke of the chunk would be. And he used it, and it was something very sophisticated and just the kind of thing that composers like Igor Stravinsky thought about a great deal.
So did it change the way you conducted at all, or the way you organized your beat?
It didn't change the way I conducted so much, but it changed the way I could listen to music and imagine how the ictus, the exact moment of the attack in music, could be really artfully crafted to propel the music in different ways.
But you didn't have the orchestra do the beat on the one.
Well, I have the orchestra do whatever's necessary.
Oh, right. Well, Michael Tilson Thomas, thank you very much for talking with us, and good luck with the San Francisco Symphony.
Thank you so much.
Michael Tilson Thomas is the new music director of the San Francisco Symphony. His new book is Michael Tilson Thomas Viva Voce. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.